now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 1230 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us. Friday edition of It's Your Turn. We are more than a week into December now. It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, time flies between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And all of a sudden, it feels like we're a week or so into December with the arrival of cold weather, and who knows? Well, maybe it's here for the duration now. I don't know. We could get another warm-up, but it's pretty cold out there today. The wind has kicked up since this morning, too. It's a little breezy, so right now we've got 28 degrees here in the city, a little colder than that in some of the outlying areas. We're going to be talking about banking on the first portion of the program today. A little bit later, we have a couple of local physicians who are going to be joining us to talk about a recent adventure experience they took. Now, heard about people who like to do outdoor adventures. Sounds kind of interesting. They decided they were going to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. Are you kidding me? Mount Kilimanjaro. Wow. Doctors Tom Shutter and Steve Sargent will be with us a little bit later on the program. Anxious to talk to them. And also, you know, we always look for stocking stuffers this time of year. Got a pretty good last-minute one for young adults, I think, from author Mira Bartok. She has penned an animal fantasy novel called The Wanderling. It's pretty neat. I think kids of all ages will enjoy this. Maybe some really older kids, too. So all that coming up a little bit later on the program today. But first, we say hello and welcome once again to our It's Your Turn studios, Clem Rosenberger. Clem is the CEO of Next Tier Bank. Mr. Rosenberger, always good to see you. Nice to have you back with us today.
Yeah, certainly nice to be here. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
We were trying to figure out when we last chatted, maybe a little over a year ago.
Yeah. I got to tell you, after that introduction, I feel a little inadequate. I mean, bank's doing very well, but none of us have climbed a mountain this year, so that's a pretty impressive story.
I heard about this, that, you know, gone on people take these adventure vacations now, you know, instead of just going to the beach. Mount Kilimanjaro, wow. Also visiting with us today is Maria Amoruso. She's a senior vice president at Next Tier. Maria, good to see you as well.
Great for us to be back and here with you, Dave.
I think there have been several developments with regard to Next Tier Bank, specifically, since we chatted. Number one, your geographical footprint is expanding, right? You're into another county now?
Yeah, that's true. Back earlier this year, we were able to acquire Manor Bank. Had two branch locations, one down in Manor, PA, and one in Irwin. So we brought those on, I think, back in April, and that really has taken off very well. We mm-hmm. had Next Tier previously was operating in Armstrong, Butler, and Allegheny. We didn't have any presence really in Westmoreland County. So because of that, we now have a great lending team there, great branch staff, and they really have done a wonderful job so far through the year for us.
Most people know where Irwin is, because it's an exit on the Pennsylvania Turnpike.
Correct.
Has been forever. Manor.
Manor is a suburb of Irwin. So,
oh, okay.
It's probably, I'd say, maybe 3 miles, probably west, a little northwest of Irwin.
Mm-hmm.
Northeast of Irwin.
Everybody connects there. It's either the Turnpike or Route 30, because both of them intersect right
Correct.
At Irwin there.
Correct.
Which one of the reasons why it's such a busy place.
We actually are hoping to have a loan production office sometime in probably first quarter next year, located right on Route 30 as mm-hmm. well. So certainly, you know, expanding into the area there.
I was looking at one of those Rand McNally road maps. Remember, you used to get them for free at gas stations
Correct,
a long,
yeah.
long time ago. Now they're like $5.95 in the bookstore. But they color what they consider the Pittsburgh metropolitan area in yellow. And I can remember looking at them, years and years ago, and it was just kind of clustered right around Pittsburgh. Now those yellow areas are up into Cranberry and Adams, and over toward Greensburg, solid yellow.
Yep.
So that territory from Monroeville to Irwin to Greensburg, even on toward Latrobe. That's all considered metropolitan Pittsburgh these days, and a lot of people commute back and forth every day.
There's clearly been, you know, significant growth throughout that area, mm-hmm. and certainly, you know, we've seen here in Butler what's happened at Granbury and Wexford. So it's nice to see all the economic activity around Pittsburgh.
So that'll give you, must be close to 30 branch offices now.
We're up to 28 at this point in time. Mm. So this past year, we also opened a loan production office up in Clarion. So we were excited to bring a great lender on board there. And then just a couple months ago, we announced that we are venturing outside of Pennsylvania. We opened a loan production office in downtown Cleveland.
Mm. Ontario is next, I assume.
Probably won't go international, although my son tells me that we should do that. So,
Clarion's a nice sized university town. There's a lot of growth up there too.
It is. Yeah. It is very nice. You know, Clarion is a nice, suburban rural type community, and really that's where Next Year Bank thrives. Mm-hmm. We really pride ourselves in getting involved in the communities that we serve, and Clarion and the surrounding area there fits that profile very well.
What's a loan production office, by the way?
It is a non-branch location. So there's specific regulations if you're opening up a branch where you're taking deposit transactions, mm-hmm. there's registration requirements. We're a national bank, so we'd have to do it through the OCC office of the Comptroller of the Currency. When it's just lending activity, there's lower requirements. There's no FDIC insurance issues involved since there's no deposit taking.
So. Does that make it, I don't want to get too much inside baseball here, but does that make it easier to go out of state, for example, and to Cleveland area?
Yeah, really the idea with these loan production offices is that we want to get up in the community. It's easy to get up and running with the loan production mm-hmm. office, get your name established, and then hopefully in the coming months or years come in with some branch locations as mm-hmm. well.
Hey, get your signage up.
Exactly.
Yeah. By the way, Next Year has a great logo signage. That's
all up to Marie and her staff.
Maria is
in charge of marketing, does an excellent job for us.
Mm, it's eye-catching, which, of course, is exactly what you want.
Correct.
Right. Yeah, we're fortunate. I have a great marketing team, and we actually have a designer on staff who created all of those. So she does a great job, and it's nice to see them out there.
Mm-hmm.
We like the blue background with the white and green logo, and really is eye-catching. So.
She also does a good job with photoshopping. We were talking, they have some headshots of me that I look a lot better in those shots than I do in person.
I won't tell you how we fix this.
Some of our listeners, many of them, will be familiar with some of the history of Next Year Bank. Some folks will not realize, though, perhaps, especially since we're talking now, loan production office in Ohio, 28 branches now, might not realize that it is, it began as a local bank and remains a local bank.
Sure. It really is the culmination of, I guess, now five, maybe six community banks. So it really is bringing the old Citizens Bank of Evans City in with what was Farmers and Merchants Bank of Western PA over in Armstrong.
Mm-hmm.
F&M Bank was really Farmers National Bank and Merchants National Bank being brought together several years ago. And then, as we just said, we brought on Manor Bank recently. We also did a acquisition in 2016 with Eureka Bank out in Oakland and Shaler, which was, within the city limits, obviously, but really operated as a community bank. And that's really, what we want to keep as our roots.
Does this seem to be the trend in the banking industry?
Consolidation all around.
Yeah. Kind of like the airline industry. That's pretty analogous, really, actually, isn't it?
Yeah. Obviously, increasing regulations, add some, costs on. Regulations for a bank our size were $1.2 billion. Regulations for our size, the same for a $100 million bank.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in today's day and age with internet security, things of that sort, you have all the IT security costs surrounding a bank. So when you start adding in all those pieces, every bank, regardless of your size, has to invest in those in that infrastructure. So It's hard to compete sometimes when you're smaller.
We're speaking, some listeners may have joined us a little bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn. That's fine. Clem Rosenberger is here. Mr. Rosenberger is the CEO, the Chief Executive Officer of Next Tier Bank. And we have a Senior Vice President here too, Maria Amoruso. And we're chatting about Next Tier and about banking in general. I feel that there are a lot of people, the majority of people, who still like to have a personal connection. I think it's important that a bank projects that. You know, we had the crisis back 9 years ago now, 8 or 9 years ago, and that phrase still sticks, banks too big to fail. That still sticks in people's craw.
It definitely
they
does.
Didn't like it then. They don't like it now. They hear about some of these mega mergers that are proposed and so on, and I've heard many people go back to that and say, what? How did we get there?
Right.
You know, if I go to the bank, I want to know somebody that's in there.
Right. No, that's definitely true. And, you know, there again, I mean, that's really what Next Tier Bank is here to serve within our population. So we want to make sure that as people come in to our branch offices, they know the individuals that they're dealing with. You know, a lot of things happen in your, account activity. You know, today there's a lot of, frauds that are taking mm-hmm. place. And, mm-hmm. when you're caught up in something like that, it's great to be able to pick up the phone or walk into branch and know who you're dealing with and know that they're going to take care of your needs for you.
Yeah. You mentioned internet security and how that's added another layer of expense to banks. Are you seeing a bigger majority of customers banking online as opposed to actually coming in to a bank, to a brick and mortar or a bank?
Yeah, I mean, certainly transactions within the traditional brick and mortar locations that we have continued to decline. Probably not as fast as most people would anticipate. Mm-hmm. Some of that is just due to the markets that we're in. Certainly, if we were in downtown Pittsburgh, my guess is those branches would experience less transaction than in some of the rural markets that we are. But people are comfortable doing business through internet banking. So, the bank certainly has to provide that avenue for them to do so. And, we take great strides to make sure that that's a secure method of dealing with the bank.
I think there are still some people, it's probably generational. I'm sure it's generational. Some people are still a little uneasy about it. And they still look at it as something new, newfangled.
Right.
Actually, banks, and I have no experience in the banking industry, so correct me if I'm wrong here, banks have been dealing in electronic transfers for years, right? I mean, aren't most of the transactions with the Federal Reserve and so on, aren't those all done electronically in the middle of the night or something like that?
Sure. I mean, ACHs have been around for decades. Wire transfers have always been there. So, money's always floated around. Now, when you bring in the internet banking side of things, could be a less secure situation than you would have, mm-hmm. Point-to-point communication with the Federal Reserve. But, there's a lot of great security programs out there to ensure the protection is there. And truthfully, there's ways through internet banking platforms now that in some ways better protect your account. I mean, being able to have a system automatically reviewing your transactions using some algorithm to make sure that Dave typically does these types of transactions. He typically goes to these types of stores, and all of a sudden, why are we seeing something in Michigan?
Mm-hmm.
That's not within Dave's common pattern.
So
having that automation
does
help.
Up.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. Where if you were relying solely on people to do that, it'd be difficult to look at all those transactions. So there certainly are benefits there.
What about the recent credit bureau problem with the, it was one of the three
right.
main credit right. reporting bureaus with a tremendous hack?
Sure.
Millions and millions of people losing
right.
information.
Right.
Does that directly or indirectly affect banks too?
It does in the sense that, as we said, I mean, banks are very well regulated. We have at least annually, sometimes more often than that, auditors coming in to make sure that we're complying with all the security protocols that we need. Unfortunately, that bank information is out there, you know, at credit bureaus, it's your credit card information is out there with retailers. That's really where we see a lot of the fraud occurring, is that these, especially in the retailer side, there's not as much regulation and effort to make sure that their systems are up to par. And, you know, when a hack occurs at one of those retail stores, a lot of times the bank ends up having that loss. Even though we weren't responsible for releasing that data, you know, it's our customer's account, and, you know, being community banks, you know, we're going to try to absorb those losses for our customers. So mm-hmm. it certainly affects us.
And some of these errors, these hacks have occurred with really big name companies. I mean, it's not little mom and pop retailers, which you might expect.
That's definitely true. You know, some of that is, you know, could be carelessness, but some of that is just, you know, hackers are going to go where the money is. And, you know, mom and pop stores don't have, you know, as big of a payday as, you know, a big national retailer would. So if they can get into, you know, a national chain store, you know, their payday is a lot larger than something local.
Have most banks now switched over to the new chip credit and debit cards, or is that process still ongoing?
It's probably ongoing. I actually just saw a report this morning right before I came that there's still a few cards that we have that don't have the chips in, but for the most part, those have all been converted over throughout the industry.
Mm-hmm. So. You still have to be cautious, you know, and I read a lot about this on Wire Stories, especially at holiday time when you're making a purchase, you know, make sure there's nobody that looking at you too closely or trying to copy down your numbers, that sort of, but you're busy, you get distracted. Last week I was paying for something at a department store and I swiped my credit card. I was half talking to the clerk, half talking to somebody behind me, and she gently said, that's a chip card. You don't swipe those anymore. Because yeah, the machines still have the swipe thing there. You know? I said, oops, that's right. You know.
Right.
So it's easy to make a mistake.
No, that's definitely true. You know, the nice thing is there are a lot of protections with your, you know, debit card or credit card. So, mm-hmm. you know, credit card companies do a pretty, you know, decent job of accepting those losses as well as from the banking side. Really, where we see a lot of consumers being hurt is, you know, outside the internet banking, outside the debit card, is just, you know, frauds that are occurring from, you know, phone calls, people getting, you know, elderly folks to release information over the phone about their bank accounts, getting involved in these schemes where, you know, hey, you know, you won the lottery, send us some money to pay the taxes, and we'll send you $1 million. We've seen, you know, kind of an uptick in that activity over the past year. You know, certainly your listeners need to be very cautious. I mean, anytime somebody calls you or sends you a letter and you've never had any contact with them, you know, people aren't out there handing out free money, and there's always a catch. And a lot of times you don't, you know, you get pulled into, you know, the pitch story too quickly, and it's easy to believe it at first. You know, before you send anybody money out of your account or give your account information away, you need to be sure and double check things.
I just had a woman call me earlier this week on the program saying she had gotten a call from someone who purported to be from the IRS, and I said, stop right there. I said, you don't have to tell me any more about your story. I said, it's a scam.
Exactly.
The Internal Revenue Service does not call people.
Right.
If you're in trouble or in arrears or whatever, they send you a letter.
Right.
Now, after you've been in contact by mail, there may be phone conversations, but they don't call you out of the blue and say, pay $700 or you're going to be arrested by a constable tomorrow.
Right.
That just doesn't happen.
Right. Yeah, and we've seen, you know, recently, you know, instances where, you know, people are calling to collect IRS debt, and they get very good at, you know, pretending to be the IRS agents or, you know, police agents, and they'll spoof their phone numbers so that if you have caller ID, you know, their phone number looks like it's coming from a police station or things that sort. So, you know, always, you know, double check those numbers, you know, call somebody who's knowledgeable in the situation and verify that data outside the phone call that you're receiving.
We'll take a quick break. We'll ask Mr. Rosenberger to take a look into his crystal ball when we come back and take a look at what might be the future of banking. You know, there are some industries that have changed so markedly in the last 10 or 15 years that they're almost unrecognizable. I don't know. Well, we'll talk about it a little bit when we come back. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. It's the Friday edition. Nice to have you aboard. We'll take a quick break. Be back and talk more with our guests here on the Friday edition right after these words.
At Butler Health System, there's more to medicine than the most advanced tools and techniques. There's the dedication to providing the most personal care, one that's shared by every member of our team, like renowned neurosurgeon Dr. Michael Horowitz.
I came to Butler because I wanted to practice medicine the way it's supposed to be done. It's truly about the patient. We get to know the people and what's important to them.
That dedication is why Butler Health System is trusted by our neighbors across the region and chosen by exceptional doctors who share our philosophy that the patient comes first, like orthopedic surgeon Charles Spingola.
I knew I'd have the tools and technology, but I also knew that there was a real commitment to genuine care. We don't treat medicine like an assembly line.
At Butler, we know what it takes to provide the very best of care, but more importantly, we know why we have to. Caring hands, remarkable minds. That's Butler Health System.
Are you searching for the perfect holiday gift for someone you care about? Well, look no further. Personalized photo calendars from Sir Speedy Printing are great gifts that last the whole year. Everyone will love the personal touch that you were able to put into your gift and appreciate the memories that come back with every picture you chose. Be the hero of holiday gifts with the help of Sir Speedy Printing on South Main Street in Butler. Stop in or give us a call today.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location downtown Butler to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Welcome back, folks. Our guests on the first portion of the program here are from Next Tier Bank. We have the CEO of Next Tier, Clem Rosenberger, here. Also, a Senior Vice President, Maria Amoruso. Certainly, people from our area invest in Next Tier Bank. Next Tier Bank has a long history of investing in the community as well. You started that way, and you're still that way.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's pretty exciting because next year we celebrate 140 years in the communities we serve. And I think one of the things that's been a pleasure for me working for Next Tier is that we make significant contributions back to the community. And I think this year we are very proud to say that we are, by the end of the year, we will be, well, actually, as of today, we're well over $1 million in donations to local community organizations. And it's something I think we're very proud of, and we can, you know, plan to continue. When you're building strong communities, you know, it makes a big difference for the people that live there.
And a lot of that money goes back into school systems. Mm-hmm. So, you know, certainly we're proud to, you know, be able to, you know, help students gain a better education. So programs that maybe have been cut from school budgets, you know, we're able to go in and provide some funding and, you know, increase those projects that those students can experience.
I run into activities and nonprofit organizations all the time that have volunteers, too, coming from the Next Tier system, helping us. Obviously, you have a commitment among your employees, if they're able to do so, to participate in those kind of things.
Right. We absolutely encourage our employees to volunteer in the communities they serve. I think it gives them a broader perspective of what's going on, and really just makes you feel good to be able to give back in that way. So, you know, between the donation, the volunteer hours, you know, our executive management team being out and about in this community and you know, all of the communities we serve, I think it says a lot It says that we're committed to these communities as we have been for the whole 140 years plus.
I think I said last time we were here, and it certainly holds true. I mean, you know, my philosophy is as the community grows, the bank will grow. If the community's not growing, then the bank can't grow as well. So we certainly are committed to help that community grow around us.
Mm-hmm. As to the future of banking in general, we don't know. You know, among the big stories the last couple of weeks on the wire, especially the financial wire, has been it's not Bitcoin, it's something else. But I scoff at these things. What are you talking about? This is Bitcoin. It's ridiculous. Of course, I am old enough to remember that when you needed cash, you went to the bank and wrote a check for cash, and then you could get cash, and sometimes you needed to get enough to carry you through maybe a couple of weeks, because otherwise you'd have to go back to the bank to get more cash. And now the ATM cards are such a, I mean, it's just part of our culture. I mean, there are a couple of generations who can't imagine what life was like without them, you know.
Well, we certainly still hand out cash at our branches, so anybody that wants to still bring in a check and write out to cash, that's perfectly fine. But you're right. I mean, certainly, you know, debit cards, ATM cards have made it easier to not carry that cash around.
Mm-hmm. And who could have predicted that?
Exactly.
25 years ago.
Right.
Absolutely.
Nobody.
I remember, when I got into banking back in the 90s, you know, people were saying, you know, banks by the year 2000 would not have any brick or mortar locations. And obviously that hasn't played out. I think there will always be a reason to have those locations. But, you know, the daily transactions are done easier out in the marketplace than coming to a central location like a bank branch. So
I think a combination of the two. You know, when Milton Berle went on television, he was one of the first shows on commercial TV. People said, well, that's it for radio. That's the end of radio. It was 1948, by the way, that Milton Berle went on TV.
Right.
And, you know, when VCRs came out, well, that's the end of movie theaters. I don't think so.
Right.
No. I agree with you. I think that at least some brick-and-mortar banking will go on. Right. I think there'll probably be more electronic banking as people become more familiar with it and more experienced. It takes a little bit more time. You know, many banks no longer send back canceled checks, which used to be SOP, right? Standard operating procedure in the banking industry.
Right.
Every month you got a thick envelope with all those checks in it. I guess we never stopped to think about how much that cost.
Right.
You know.
No, that's definitely true. I remember those days. In fact, my guess is we kind of hoard some of that paperwork. So my guess is I probably still have some of those canceled checks sitting in a file cabinet somewhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, things have changed. Obviously, the banking industry has to continue to change. But, you know, as that change occurs, we want to offer, you know, new delivery channels to customers, but continue to serve the customers that we have.
Mm-hmm. We kind of mentioned in a joking manner next year going to Ontario. Next, what about international banking? Is there a future for that? Is that just for the ultra rich hedge fund guys or the average person someday? Who knows?
Well, I mean, there's clearly, you know, international banks, you know, operating in the U.S. that people bank with on a daily basis. You know, obviously, if you're international, you're going to be a lot larger than what Next Year Bank is.
And isn't it kind of a niche market, though, for, like, businesses, for example, with, imports, exports, and all that kind of stuff?
Sure.
Like a business all over the world?
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly their, you know, key customer base would be, you know, a fairly sophisticated business that has a lot of international dealings.
Mm-hmm. I mean, why would I ever do banking with a bank in Germany, for goodness
right.
sakes?
Correct.
I know, Deutsche Bank, it's one of the biggest in the world.
Yeah. Right.
If I have a question, what am I going to do? Take a flight to Frankfurt to get it figured out? I don't think so.
Right. It's definitely true.
Yeah. I'd rather go to one of the local offices. Well, gosh, folks, thanks for stopping in and giving us a little update here. We like to keep up to date on the local businesses and industry in general. And there's certainly been a sea change in the banking industry over the past couple of generations. So we appreciate talking to you today.
Well, thanks for having us. Merry Christmas to you and the staff here and to all of your listeners.
Yes, it'll be here before we know it, that's
it's
for
coming
sure.
Coming quick.
It sure is.
Clem Rosenberger. Mr. Rosenberger is the CEO of Next Tier Bank and Senior Vice President Maria Amoruso with us here today. Let me see. Well, we're still in the 20s. I'm sending you back out into the cold. I'm sorry.
Yeah, see if we can get that temperature up just a little bit.
Our next guest, I have a feeling, I don't know anything about Mount Kilimanjaro except that it's in Africa. I don't know. When you climb to the top of that, is it snowing in the middle of the summer? I don't know. We'll find out. We have a couple of local physicians who decided to take an adventure vacation, and that's where they went, Kilimanjaro. That's next on the It's Your Turn program. Stick around. Much more to come on the Friday edition. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. We need a couple of minutes here to get our new guests in and get them mic'd up and ready to go. We'll be right back. For so many of us, a loving pet is, well, it's a member of the family, isn't it? If you're looking for a veterinarian you can trust when it comes time for a checkup or treatment for a pet that's ill, consider Suburban Animal Clinic and Dr. Dennis Damon. Route 8 south of Butler, 4 miles south of Butler, right at the intersection of Route 8 South and Thorncrest Drive. Dr. Damon treats small animals, dogs, cats, all small animals, and exotic pets, too. If you have a question about illness, symptoms, shots, a checkup, if you need to talk to someone about concerns with an aging pet or a pet near the end of life, you can trust Dr. Dennis Damon. He loves animals. He's a pet owner himself. Dr. Dennis Damon, veterinarian at Suburban Animal Clinic. Hours by appointment only, Monday through Saturday. Credit cards are accepted, and he makes house calls, too. Dr. Dennis Damon, Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, 4 miles south of Butler at the intersection of Route 8 and Thorncrest Drive. Phone 287-5289.
Since 1938, Hunter Truck Sales has been a leader in the trucking industry. With 19 locations, they've grown to be the largest heavy truck dealership network in the Northeast. Proudly, Hunter has employed generations of families in the region and would like to take this opportunity to wish everyone a joyous Christmas and a healthy, happy, and prosperous new year.
Hunter Truck Sales, providing solutions for all your trucking needs. Check out huntertrucksales.com for truck inventory, careers, and locations.
Hey, folks, do you realize how long Miller's Shoes has been a presence on Main Street in downtown Butler? Would you believe 125 years? Yes, they're celebrating their 125th anniversary. Families have been shopping for quality and value at Miller's Shoes for well over a century. They're at 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. And with winter weather on us, Miller's Shoes is your headquarters for overshoes and boots for the bad weather. Timberland Shoes and Boots, for example. Many other famous name brands, too. Rockport, Trotters, and all of your famous name brand athletic shoes. Miller's Shoes, also your local headquarters for America's favorite comfort shoes, SAS Shoes. You'll find them for men and women, various styles and colors, at Miller's Shoes. And don't forget, for gift giving, gift certificates. What a great idea for a holiday gift for someone special. A gift certificate from Miller's Shoes. Stop in, talk to Jimmy Chipran and the folks at Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. Welcome back, good friends. Nice to have you with us on the It's Your Turn program on a Friday. If you're joining us a little bit late, that's grand, no problem. My name is Dave Malarkey. We're going to be chatting with two local physicians who have taken what I would have to call the adventure trip of a lifetime, climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. Let's say hello to our guest. First of all, Dr. Tom Shedder is here. Tom, good to see you.
Nice to see you, Dave. Thanks for having us.
And also Dr. Steve Sargent. Steve, good to see you as well.
Yes, good seeing you, Dave.
Nice to have you both safe and sound back here in the good old U.S. of A. I was telling my earlier guest about all I know with regard to Mount Kilimanjaro is that it's in Africa. I am correct on that, right?
Yes, sir. You are correct on that. It's in Tanzania.
Now, have you done adventure-type vacations before, or was this something new?
Well, Steve has done a few more than I have. I've done a few of them. I've not on this same scale, certainly, but I've done some running the rivers and rapids. Did those out in Snake River out in Idaho. But this is the first big sort of climb thing for me.
Well, I was thinking, you know, if I were going to do my first big climb, I think I might pick Shikora Hill or something like that, you know. Mount Kilimanjaro. Wow. Any ballpark figure, Steve, on the height? I don't want to get too specific here, but
well, the actual mountain is the tallest one in Africa, and actually the tallest freestanding mountain in the world, and it's 19,431 feet, or no, 19,341
feet.
341.
So that is when you say freestanding, as compared to Everest, which is in the Himalayan chain of mountains?
Correct. Mm. Yeah, so this is actually a volcano. It's an inactive volcano.
So there's no other mountains all around it, huh?
No, there's about three other volcanoes, but they have already blown their tops, and many millions of years ago, I think.
It's not totally unique. I'm thinking, is it Mount Fuji in Japan would be similar? I've seen photographs. It seems to be kind of off by itself. I don't have a whole lot of experience. I've been in the White Mountains many times up in New England, and that's a whole range just like the Himalayas, you know. The presidential range are all named after U.S. presidents.
Yes.
Kilimanjaro, wow. Snow at the top?
There's not snow, but there's a glacier, and the glacier is slowly receding. They say, I think, by another 15, 20 years, it will no longer be there, and it'll be just a, there won't be any snow up there. But we did not have to walk across any snow. And it only, we had a little sleet and snow one day when we were at about 15,000 feet at Lava Tower.
Now this, Dr. Tom Shetter, this is recent. You just did this fall, right?
Just about 2 months ago.
Is it a long, involved, I mean, obviously, first thing you have to do is fly to Africa, which is not easy to do to begin with. That's quite a trip, isn't it?
Yes. Well, we spent basically, you know, we started planning a year before we traveled. And so, but yeah, the first thing we did was actually book the flights. And it was surprisingly easier than we thought. We, the most economical fares were out of Dulles in Washington, D.C. So we flew from Dulles into Amsterdam.
Okay.
And then from Amsterdam, it takes you direct on a wide-body jet to the, what they call the Kilimanjaro Airport. And it's, you know, it's about 2 hours drive away from there. So it's actually, you know, much easier than I thought it would be. I thought it was going to take several connections to get us there.
You can fly right from Amsterdam to Tanzania, huh?
Yes, there's a flight in each day on KLM Airlines, and there's other airlines that also fly in, but that was the one that worked best for us.
I would have to think that at least a sizable majority of the people flying in there are going to see Kilimanjaro, the mountain, right?
Someone estimated to us that about 30% of the people that fly in are going to go on the climb, and the other 70% are going to do safari, because there's quite a number of places to safari, you know, within distance from there.
Did you do that too, or did you just climb, Steve?
No, the second week I stayed for the safari. We went kind of across the northern part of Tanzania to three different parks and went on safari, and then we flew back from the furthest park back ultimately back to Kilimanjaro Airport.
So flight time, Washington to Amsterdam, is probably 6-7 hours. Similar from Amsterdam to Tanzania?
8 hours to Amsterdam and 8 hours to Tanzania. And then on the ride home from the from the airport, you fly to Dar es Salaam, which is the capital, and then from Dar es Salaam, it is 8 hours all the way to
It's a long time, long time on a jet aircraft.
Yes, very long.
Indeed it is, but it was actually, it actually went really fast. There's plenty of things to do, and you got, I sat to, on the way to Kilimanjaro Airport, I sat next to a couple who were Dutch, and I got to talk to them. They were going to do the climb as well, so it was interesting talking to them.
Now, to do the climb, you mentioned obviously the first thing you had to do was decide when you're going, make flight arrangements to get to Tanzania. What about arranging to go on the climb? I'm assuming you had to do all of that in advance, too, or maybe not. Huh?
Yes. I mean, we did it through a company called BioBio that does many worldwide expeditions, kind of if you want to do anything adventurous anywhere in the world. You can do it through them. They're based in, I think, Peru or somewhere in South America.
That was their original place where they were, but they're actually based out of California.
Oh, they are now.
That's where their prime offices are.
And so they made all the arrangements, and we did it through a medical group called Wilderness Medicine. And so it was actually, there were some lectures that were given on the mountain and then during the safari. About wilderness medicine. Mainly we talked a lot about altitude sickness and such and what you can do about it and how you can train for it and things like that while we were there, which didn't help us much because we were already there.
A little bit about the seasons, first of all. I'm certainly not familiar with Tanzania's climate. I dare say I doubt most of our listeners are either. Do you have to go at a certain time of the year to go on this climb? I mean, do they have deep winter and blazing hot summer there, or is it more of a temperate climb?
It's more temperate, but there are better times to go. There are certain rainy seasons, and you wouldn't want to be doing the climb on the rainy season because the rocks, the volcanic rock is already slippery enough, and so you'd try and avoid rainy season. So we were, October is just before the early sort of fall rainy season, and we were very fortunate. As Steve said, we had one little episode where we had a little bit of sleet and snow when we were up at about 15,000 feet. So you want to avoid it probably in November and December, and then February or March it starts to get a little better, and then there's lots of people climbing. Every day there's groups climbing and climbing and climbing. So, but a lot of people travel to accommodate children, you know, and students and everything else. Mm-hmm. So August through September are the really busy times on the mountain. Then it gets a little lighter at various other points.
You have local guides who, obviously, you wouldn't have any idea where to go if you didn't have a guide, right?
Right. In our particular group, there were 18 climbers. There were 55 porters who carried stuff, and then there were 9 guides that went along.
So it was a sizable party.
Yes,
going up there. I know very little about mountain climbing. Seen some movies, read a few books. Guns of Navarone is my all-time favorite, but that was just one cliff, you know, going up. I do know, for example, on trips up Everest, they have to have base camps and then camp one and camp two. Did you need that sort of an approach at Kilimanjaro?
Yes, we ended up going to, I think there were 5 different camps before we actually did the summit climb. And the summit climb is you kind of get to the 5th camp and you take a little nap in the afternoon, and then they wake you up and you have a little snack before you start climbing at around midnight. And then you climb all night so that you summit about 7:30 in the morning. So, yes, we went through 5 different camps, and those are so that we can acclimate to the altitude. So each one is a little bit higher. They try to make you climb a little higher than that during the day, and then you come back down a little bit to sleep each night. And then we slowly, probably it was about 1,500, somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 feet difference between each of our camps. So we were slowly getting higher. And then the last camp is about 15,000 feet. And then you do the final climb overnight, the 3,000 or so feet up.
Do you have to use oxygen as you get toward the upper regions?
No, you don't need oxygen for any of this. Though I think we passed some people who would have liked to have had some oxygen with them.
Well, you know, we hear this about, when the Pittsburgh Pirates go to play Colorado, you know, in baseball, they worry. There's a noticeable difference when the Steelers go to play the Denver Broncos out there. Mm-hmm. You know, you can kick field goals 10 or 15 yards longer because of the thin air. You're a heck of a lot higher than Denver.
Yeah, nearly 4 times higher, actually.
Yeah.
Denver's about 5,000 feet.
So you didn't need oxygen, but did you notice it? Did you find yourself, I don't know, what, did you get short of breath or what?
Oddly enough, I wasn't as short of breath as I thought I was going to be. Now, the guides, you're going slowly through those areas because mm-hmm. you really just can't push yourself so hard because you will create more mountain sickness.
Yeah.
So, but they checked our oxygen regularly, like every time at breakfast and dinner time, they would actually use a little digital pulse oximeter upon us,
mm-hmm.
and you could see in a lot of people's oxygen saturations were lower, but oxygen saturation isn't all, without getting too technical, isn't all about the numbers, because when you're breathing faster like you are, you're part of the natural response is you breathe faster, and so you actually get more oxygen into your tissues that way. But surprisingly, I was not as short of breath as I thought I was going to be. We had spoken to a young fella, a cardiologist here in Butler, who had done it, and he recalls being very short of breath his entire climb that night, but it wasn't nearly as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Do you go to the very top?
Yes. Yeah, there's kind of two tops. One is, because when you get to the top, you're kind of at the top of a big crater, and mm-hmm. I would guess the crater was maybe 500 yards across or something like that.
Because it's a volcano, right?
It's a volcano.
It's an
yes.
extinct volcano, yep.
Yes. But when you get to that point, then you have to kind of walk around it about a third of the way around it to get to the true peak. And then, so whenever you're at the true peak, I think we're about 500 feet higher than we were.
It's really not a big difference, but it takes a while to get there. You have a bit of a walk, and this is after you've been hiking for 7+ hours, sort of straight up through the night.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, that last part then, I guess, is the hardest. That's the steepest climb?
No, actually, it's a pretty flat climb. The very last part up to that point is
right.
Fairly steep. It's kind of, the whole climb is fairly steady for that 7 hours that you're walking.
Do you go, I'm sorry, if my questions are elementary, forgive me. I know when you're driving, like on the Skyline Drive down in West Virginia, you go up and down mountains in almost a circular pattern, you know. Sometimes you drive around them to get up. Is that the way the trail is when you're going up there, or are you just going straight up?
No, you're not going straight up. You do a lot of switchbacks, mm-hmm. where you're kind of snaking up the path.
Most of the very final night is like that. Now, we summited on the sixth night, so the other climbs leading up to that, a lot of times you're climbing up pretty high, and then you're climbing, so you're going up and down valleys, and, you know, the trail is, you know, it's not like a paved trail, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of walking. You're walking through rocks, so it's a lot of caution, you know, going from place to place so you don't slip and fall. And then everything is just much farther than it seems. That's all. Everything, it looks like, oh, it's just a few minutes away, and 2 hours later you're still walking your way over there. I mean, we would literally hike anywhere from 6 to 8 hours every day to get to that point where we spent the 7 hours zigzagging up the mountain.
Well, that's the way, maybe they still do it, I don't know. Where I grew up along the Allegheny River, there was a tremendous railroad switchback to get trains from the bottom of the Allegheny Gorge up to the top of the mountain in Foxburg. And that's it. They would just go up toward Edmonton for a mile and then come back down again and then go back up again. You travel a long distance just to get up a hill because otherwise the grade would be too steep to do it.
Yep.
Couldn't make it in a train or in a human body. We'll take a break. More questions for our guests. If you're joining us a little bit late, they just this fall climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in Africa. What an experience. Wow. Quick break, and then we'll talk more. One of our sponsors on the program today is Jones Turkey Farm. They're local, Jones Road in Cabot. Pretty hard to imagine getting a fresher turkey than that, huh? But there's more. Their turkeys are so tasty, and with good reason, because they're all natural. They're guaranteed that there's no preservatives, there's no additive. They're fed specifically non-GMO grain. Natural free-roaming turkeys handled with extreme care. That's why they taste so good. They are the best. And right now, Dave Jones is offering a special as a thank you to his loyal customers throughout the years. From now through December 19th, this is the 8th already, The Jones Turkey Farm is lowering the price of a frozen turkey from $3.25 a pound down to $2.50. That's right. Best turkeys in western Pennsylvania can be yours for $2.50 a pound. Want more info? Check their website. All the details are there, and it's easy to remember the website, jonesturkeyfarm.com. jonesturkeyfarm.com. Jones Road in Cabot. Make your holiday season merry by getting a Jones turkey for the whole family to enjoy. They are simply the best. We'll be right back.
At Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, our orthopedic surgeons, sports medicine specialists, physiatry, and rheumatology experts are committed to your health. Whether it's joint pain, a sports injury, a workers' comp injury, or you need help managing your arthritis or chronic pain, their physicians provide high-quality care to patients in 7 locations, including 2 right here in Butler and 1 in Slippery Rock. Tri-Rivers accepts most major insurance plans, including Highmark and UPMC. Learn more at TriRiversMSK.com. Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, partnering with the Butler community for more than 20 years.
A lot of folks, if you're joining us a little bit late, folks, our guests are two local physicians, Dr. Steve Sargent and Dr. Tom Shetter. They both recently traveled this fall, October, right?
Yes.
To Africa, to Tanzania, and climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. A lot of folks, when they hear that word, Kilimanjaro, they think of Ernest Hemingway, great American novelist. That was one of his most famous books, right? The Snows of Kilimanjaro. I assume he spent considerable time there. He was a big safari guy, wasn't he, one time?
I think so. I don't know that much about him.
Yeah.
He led a rather an adventurous life, you know, Spain, and then he ended up down in the Key West area. Ernest Hemingway. No Ernest Hemingway tourist stops or anything there.
No, there was no. There's no monument or anything to Hemingway.
Speaking of which, is it at all touristy anywhere? I've been to a few places that are pretty famous in the world, and it's getting a little kitschy, you know, in some spots.
Not
there.
No, there's a few like malls and a few shops that that we went to that are pretty much cater to the non-African clientele.
Mm-hmm.
When you're on the hike, no, you don't feel that at all. You don't feel like it's touristy, though it is crowded on the mountain. There's a lot of people that are doing this same climbing. They often do, you know, many different routes to go up the mountain. We went up a little bit slower than some do, but they also have a much better success rate taking this route. We had of 18 of us that started the climb, 12 of them actually made the summit. So it's, you know, not guaranteed that if you get there that you're going to be able to make it to the top. Mm-hmm.
People of all ages attempt this, Tom?
Well, oddly enough, so the day after summit, we didn't talk to too many people on the way up, although part of people in our group, there were a number of ages, from the 50s, and the oldest man was 70.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very experienced climber. He was the sort of lead physician from our group. But coming down the hill, interestingly enough, I ran into a very nice little thin British lady who informed me she was 71 and she had summited. And there was another group of jolly New Zealanders, and they were yucking it up down the on our last day, and one of the gentlemen was blind, and I had seen him on the summit.
Wow.
So yeah, it was quite interesting. So from young people, the same young couple that I met on the airplane on the ride down, on the way out, as you leave, you're at what they call the Moweka Gate. It's at about 6,000 feet. That's the last place you hike to, and that's where everybody leaves from.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran into them down there, and they had made it to the top, but their guide had not let them go, made it to the first peak, what they called the Stella Point, but their guide did not feel comfortable letting them go to the Uhura Point. So they were disappointed, but they realized that, you know, it was for their own safety that mm-hmm. he didn't feel that they should go to the next point. So,
Wow. Tom indicated, Steve, that you've done maybe more of these adventure-type trips than he has.
I have in the sense with the Boy Scouts, I went to their high adventure camps in mm-hmm. Philmont, and then one in Seabase, which is down in Florida, not not climbing, more scuba diving there. And then I also did a canoe trip up in the wilderness of Canada with the Boy Scouts. So I've done those type trips and maybe done a little bit more climbing and camping than Tom had done. But
canoe trip, rapid water type thing?
No. It was through the wilderness up in Canada, and it was, it's one of those trips where you don't really see anybody else for about 7 or 8 days, and just canoe on the river and kind of live off, it was just fun. It was good with the Boy Scouts.
A lot of people think that's pretty close to heaven if you can go about 8 days without seeing anybody else. That's a lot of people's idea of a vacation, you know.
True.
And that's why some people do this. These are becoming more popular, I understand.
Yeah, a lot of young people like to do these things, and you can use lots of different outfitters. REI, a local company that they do many trips and things like that all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any future aspirations? Anything that you've added to your bucket list that you'd like to do?
No, I haven't. Don't think I'll probably climb any higher than I did climbing Kilimanjaro. This is a walk up the mountain. I don't really have any interest in technical climbs, and in order to do a lot of other mountains, you have to do some technical
ropes
things.
And those spikes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, or ice axes and crampons and things like that, and I'm not really looking for that.
I don't think I'm looking for that either. I've seen documentaries of people doing that, where they climb out, go out and up over a rock. I'm sitting there, these people are nuts. Obviously, they're in great shape. By the way, that would be a factor, right? You want to be in general good health before you start out on one of these trips.
Yes, I mean, that can help you. If you can spend some time at altitude before you go there, just before you go there, then that can pay off. But we didn't have that luxury, so we did train so that we were in good cardiovascular shape, but the biggest concern out there is altitude, and it's really hard to train for altitude.
You mentioned, Steve, mountain sickness. What's that? Is that similar to, like, the bends that you get if you come up from scuba diving too fast, or is there something totally different?
Well, I mean, it's different, but it's a acute mountain sickness is the milder form of it, which gives you a headache. You don't want to eat. You feel, real sleepy, but you have trouble sleeping. You generally, you mainly just feel nauseated and headache.
Sounds like a downward spiral. You feel sleepy, but you don't want to sleep, and you don't want to eat.
Right. And then you can get other forms of it, whether you get pulmonary edema from it, which is fluid in the lungs, and then you can also get cerebral edema, which is swelling of your brain, which is not a good thing at all.
I wouldn't think so. Yeah. Do they have capabilities for taking somebody back down if they get, two-thirds of the way up and they're seriously ill or something like that?
They most certainly do, and that's one of the things that people need to look for in an outfitter, to make sure that they have that. So they have different things that they can do. They have what they call, I believe it's a GAMWO bag, which they can actually put you in and pressurize it so it actually makes it like you're getting more oxygen. Of course, they do carry oxygen tanks with them. And that's why one of the reasons why they have a number of guides is because, we had of the 18 of us that went, three people decided in the midst of it that they couldn't go. One was a 15-year-old boy. It was two physicians and their son, who was 15.
Mm-hmm.
And just before we had one of our more strenuous hikes, he just had terrible mountain sickness. He couldn't take a step without vomiting, and he was just miserable. So the three of them elected to go down. So one of the guides went with them to get them to an evacuation point, and then they were fine once they got down. He was fine once he got down from altitude. But yeah, so they're, and interestingly enough, and we have some pictures of them. They have these. We might call them a unicycle stretcher. So it's a stretcher with one tire underneath it that they could put you on and roll you downhill. It wouldn't be very comfortable, but it would get you downhill, because the treatment for mountain sickness is get down from the mountain, get down from altitude.
Was there ever any time that you felt trepidation, that you felt you were in danger in any way?
I didn't really feel I was in danger. I did get some mountain sickness whenever we climbed to a place called Lava Tower, and that's at like 15,000 feet. We just had lunch there, and then we went down to sleep for the night. And while I was there, I had the headache and didn't want to eat, and you know, just felt pretty miserable. But that went away once I went down about 1,500 feet.
Mm-hmm. And they do that on a regular basis. Whenever you bunk down for the night, you go back down a little ways.
Yeah, they call it climb high and sleep low, and that's how you get used to the altitude.
I never heard of that before. Yeah. That's fascinating. Yeah.
The very first night when we went from 5,000 feet, which is where we started, to 10,000 feet, which was our first camp, that was my worst night. I was real nauseated, just felt horrible. And I could not sleep like the entire night. And part of that, you also take a lot of medicine when you're there, and mm-hmm. you take malaria pills. And some of the malaria pills tend to make you a little anxious and such. So I had taken it a little too close to bedtime, so I really didn't sleep well the first night. But after that, I started taking the mornings, and I acclimated, and I never had a problem after that. But.
How were the meals when you were going up there? Did they have good cooks in your crew? Was the food palatable?
Yes, the food was wonderful, actually, on the way up, and it was aesthetically pleasing also. They go to a lot of trouble to make it look pretty.
Really?
On top of that. And
I picture you sitting around a campfire with, you know, one of those tin plates like the cowboys used to use, you know, out of the chuck wagon.
We had two cooks, the guys who did all the cooking, and you know, they have to carry all the food with them.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We could see porters carrying stacks of cartons of eggs. So we had like omelets for bread. You know, they make a big omelet and cut into pieces. And we had that. They had fresh fruit every day. In the mornings, when they would wake us in the mornings from our tents, it was two persons to a tent, and they would wake us and bring hot water, and if you wanted coffee or tea or something, you know, that was to wake you up. So they really did a nice job. And there was plenty of food. You know, every day after the hike, there'd be a little snack first while they were making dinner, and then, the food was surprisingly quite good. I was really impressed by that.
Were you mainly hiking and climbing on rocks? Was there some dirt there?
Yeah, the first day you climb through rainforest, and then we camped outside of the rainforest. And then after that, there's really not much growth around. Whenever I've climbed Ike in Colorado, you get to a certain altitude, and then there's like nothing above it, just rocks. And there, that wasn't quite the case. You did have some scrubby-type plants and some little bushes and trees. But for the most part, it's just very dusty. There's lots of, you kind of choke on the dust at times, especially on the way down. But even on the way up, you get a lot of dust.
That's interesting. It would be solidified lava for the most part, right? If it was an extinct volcano.
Right, yeah. A lot of it's lava rock, so it's sharp and a little bit slippery.
Yeah, that's why I was asking about that.
And then you wind up going through what they call a scree field, which is just a lot of loose dust and rock, and that's the stuff he was, you know, referring to. And you're basically you do a climb through the harder stuff, and then at the very end you spend a lot of time, and it's very slow because you take a step and you slide back a little bit and everything. But on the way down, you almost sort of ski your way out to the most part.
But there was never a time that you were, like, looking over the edge of a precipice and it was, you know, 5,000 feet straight down or something like that?
No, nothing that bad. You do climb up they call it the Barranco Wall.
Barranco Wall.
Barranco Wall. And it's a, you do it first thing in the morning, and it's a fairly steep wall that you kind of zigzag back. And there's places there where you're kind of sidestepping across while you hold on to some rock handholds as you shimmy across. Now, if you fell from there, you'd probably only fall about 20 feet before you ran into something.
That's enough for me. That's fine. No problem.
Yeah, that was the most difficult day of scrambling kind of things. And it was a day where my legs were particularly tired, and you had to do some things where you really had to push off with your thighs. And, it was challenging for me. That was my tiredest day. And then we had a young lady on who was very afraid of heights, and she had a few little panic attacks, but rarely managed to make it through. She really, really did great.
The highest I ever was going up Mount Washington in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. One day we were going to do it, and there were clouds at the top. So there was no visibility, and so we waited till the next day. Were there clouds at the top of Kilimanjaro, or could you see forever?
No, the when we were there that time of year, there's a cloud cover that's probably present around about, 10,000 feet or something like that. And so from the whole time, every time you wake up in the morning, you look down at this cloud cover below you. But then around 2 in the afternoon, clouds would come in more at our level. And so it would get more, one, it would get colder because the sun wasn't warming us anymore.
Yeah.
And it also got, misty.
So kind of like when you're in an airplane, once you get above the cloud cover, you're above all the weather that's down there on Earth. What was the topography of Tanzania like, other than going up the mountain? Is that mostly rainforest, or is that desert, or somewhere in between? Or
yeah, a lot of flat plain kind of desert, but there's interspersed trees, and then you do have some true forest. Whenever we climbed down, we went back through the rainforest, and so you'll see some animals down there. We didn't really see any animals other than birds once we got above about 12,000 feet. But below that, there's rainforest, and there's lots of monkeys and other things down there, and a lot of tree cover, so you're not really even in the sun.
No, when you went, Steve, on safari, I'm trying to think of that term. Is it savanna land? Is that a term? I don't know. But it's kind of half between desert and it's not rainforest. There's a lot of open territory. It's where you see the documentaries about the giraffes and the lions and so on and so forth. Is that the kind of territory you were on safari in?
Yes, and then there's usually a stream or something that's snaking its way through, and that's where all the vegetation is. But out in the vast majority of it, it's just kind of desert looking. But there is some scrubs and a little tree here and there that you'd find lions laying under and stuff.
Did you hike that, or did they have like Land Rovers or something?
We had Land Rovers. You wouldn't want to hike it because you might become something's meal.
That's right, like a lion or something.
Yeah, a lion or cheetahs or leopards, all those things.
Would you do this again? I mean, obviously you've already done Kilimanjaro. You're not going to go back there next year, but
I particularly don't have an interest, as Steve mentioned, since it's a walking climb. This is the only kind of climb that I could really do, because I don't have interest in the more technical climb.
Well, you need a lot of training to do technical climbing. That's
most definitely, and you have to have upper arm strength, which I have very little of. So,
But more adventure trips, maybe? Riding the rapids down the snake again?
Well, once of that was enough, but
Go to a higher pile. It's not quite so far.
Right. Well, I have good friends who we've talked about doing the Grand Canyon, possibly.
Uh-huh.
We've done that. So we'll just have to see. I'm getting old now.
Well, you always have to, when you're doing these, I mean, they're tremendous adventures. I'm excited just listening to you guys recount the tale, to be honest with you. But you have to respect Mother Nature. Like those Grand Canyon things, I've heard some real horror stories about sudden rainfall that'll just, they'll just fill those canyons up in a heartbeat,
Right, yeah, you really have to be going at the right time and with the right guides and, to make it as safe as it possibly is.
Mm-hmm. Any desire to go to any other continents? You've done Africa. That's usually the last one on most people's list. You've already been there.
Well, I've not been to Australia and New Zealand, which I'd like to do now. Steve has been there, so.
I've been to Australia. Never been to South America. We probably will make a trip there. Never been to Alaska. I'd like to go there. Been to Europe. Going to next year, we'll be going to Prague. and Czechoslovakia and Budapest. And so,
I've heard nice things about some of those river trips in some of those towns where you can go on the Rhine or the Danube or some of those.
Yeah, last year I did the Rhine, and that was beautiful. Started out in Amsterdam, ended up in Switzerland, and then this trip next year is a river cruise also.
Mm-hmm.
But going from Budapest to Prague.
Was there any recovery time needed after you came back from such a high altitude? Did you have to wait around for a couple of days before you could fly home, for example, Tom?
No, altitude was the easiest thing to get used to. I mean, just coming down the mountain, you feel just much more normal. When we were on the mountain, even though we weren't having bad mountain sickness, I was never really that hungry. You ate because you knew you needed the calories to climb with. But coming back down, when you go from the summit, which is 19,000, we stayed at camp that at about 14,000 the next night, and then we hiked all the way down to 6,000, and it's much faster. It's almost like a straight shot out. Mm-hmm. It's an exit route that they created, and it's just literally walking downhill for five. It took us 5.5 hours to get from the one camp, and then since you're using your muscles so much differently, your quadriceps you have a hard time getting out of a chair. Mm-hmm. Really, mm-hmm. the day following that, and as it turns out, there's no problem leaving soon, and I ultimately had to leave soon. I had a little issue with an eye, and we were on the trip with an ophthalmologist, and he recommended it to be certain I should go home and get it checked. So I left early before the fun part of the safari. So I had quite a long slog and flight there. I mean, I got back to our hotel and had an hour to pack, and then back to the airport, flight, and then we had actually driven to Washington, D.C. together, and he wasn't coming home, so I had to get a flight home from D.C., and it was 9 hours after my flight arrived, and it was just like it was a really grueling trip, but I made it home, and my eye is fine, so I'm happy.
Well, what a wonderful experience. Wow. And you, of course, have tons of pictures to share with people, right?
A couple thousand.
I would imagine. Yeah. Well, one of the great things nowadays, most people don't have to worry about running out of film. That used to be a problem,
Yes.
Do I have enough film?
Used to be a terrible problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd get down and you never knew whether your pictures were going to be any good, but now you do.
Now you have the opportunity to just keep shooting and shooting, and it doesn't matter how many you shoot, and you can always delete the ones you don't want. As opposed to the 35-millimeter days, it cost money.
Right.
I wonder if those 35-millimeter cameras are worth anything these days. Probably not. Huh?
Some people still use them, but I don't think, and I have a whole pile of equipment for 35-millimeter cameras sitting in my house.
So do I, but I don't even know where you'd buy film anymore these days.
Yeah.
Specialty shop, I guess. No professional photographers use those anymore. I was talking to a guy a couple of months ago. He said, No. Why would we use those?
Right, no, but their high-end cameras are every bit as more expensive now, I understand it.
Yeah.
We were at an architectural photo shoot, and the camera the guy showed me was like $19,000 or something like that. Yeah,
wow.
Crazy.
Hey, thanks a lot for sharing with us here. I really was able to kind of vicariously be with you on that trip. That's really nice. And I know the first thing I'm going to do when I finish the program today is go online and start looking up a little stuff about Kilimanjaro and take a picture. I want to see where you are up there. That's nice. Our guests, two local physicians, Dr. Steve Sargent, Dr. Tom Shetter. And it was just recently, folks, a couple of months ago, they were at the top of Mount Kilimanjaro. Nice to have them with us here today. We need to take a break. Our final guest will join us by telephone today. She is Mira Bartok. And we tried to find a couple of last-minute stocking stuffers for you here and there over the last week or so, and we got another one coming up especially for young adult readers. It's a fun book. It's called The Wonderling. We'll tell you all about it, or Mira will, right after these words. We'll be back in just a moment.
Looking for a way to make your company's benefit package a little more competitive? Here's one that's so easy, more than 130 local organizations and businesses have added it to their programs. Membership in Armco Credit Union. At Armco Credit Union, your employees will have access to the best loan rates and more free banking services, while direct deposit and payroll deduction options make it convenient for both of you. And best of all, it doesn't cost you a thing. Learn more at armcocu.com or by calling 284-2020. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is insured by NCUA.
Lottery numbers for today. The pick two is 42. The pick three is 196. Pick four, 9486. Pick five, 86041. Wild ball for each of those is one. The treasure hunt, 4, 6, 18, 19, and 30. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $50,000.
As you know, listeners, we're always looking for last-minute stocking stuffer gifts this time of year, and I think we've come across a pretty good one. It's a book called The Wonderling by Mira Bartok, and guess what? She's going to visit with us for the next few minutes here on It's Your Turn on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey. Mira, nice to meet you. Terrific to have you with us here today.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So what do you think? A perfect last-minute stocking stuffer gift for a middle school-type student, the Wonderling. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, my book begins and ends at Christmas, and it's, you know, for that sort of early, that beginning Harry Potter series age, you know, like 10 and up, although I think it makes a great read-aloud for kids a bit younger. And one of the last readings I had, book signing events, I had a woman there who was 100 years old, and she loved it. So
I was going to say, I think there are a lot of adults who would like it as well. Give us a little capsule look at the plot of your book. You feature a wonderful fox who's a little bit different from others, right? He's only got one ear.
Well, and not only that, he's the creatures in my book who are not technically human, because there are humans. They're called groundlings, and they are half human, half animal. And so my main character starts out at the beginning with a name, number 13, because he's an orphan. He doesn't know where he comes from. He doesn't know his history. He looks like a boy. As you know, when he stands up, he looks like a boy, but he's covered in red furry fur, and he has the face and he doesn't have a tail, but he has the head of a fox dog like creature, and he has only has one ear, and that becomes important later on, and it's a great adventure story. It's got a lot of humor. It's but also there's a lot of social issues that, you know, can be talked about, because it's very Dickensian. You know, it's sort of set around that time that you would, you know, think about Dickens, say Hard Times, or there's a little Oliver Twist in there. So it's a big adventure story. It's about wonder. It's about empathy and friendship and hope. I would say those are the main themes running through it.
And you let your groundlings stand in for other disenfranchised groups. So there's a lot of subtle lessons being passed on here as people read your book, right?
Yeah, I mean, I never started out to teach a lesson. I think, you know, books that start out that way, like, I'm going to teach a lesson and write this book in order to do it, they never really come out that well. But what happens is, you know, I think if you're an empathetic writer, and you're very in tune to, say, how different groups are treated unfairly, if you know children, you're very aware of bullying that goes on in schools and so on. And definitely my main character is bullied, so there's, you know, and that's been an issue that's come up a lot this past year. So yeah, all that stuff sort of filters in, and the groundlings are the lowest on the stratosphere in my little world, and they have to learn how to empower themselves.
So you're not pounding people over the head, but you do have a goal of empowering those with disabilities. That's the message that kind of rings through, correct?
No, not actually. I mean, I would say they don't have disabilities. They're not. They're just different. They're different than the class in power. I would say that what's more significant is, you know, what I hope my readers take away is that they feel empathetic even to the villains in the book. Mm-hmm. So it's really more about empathy. You know, I'm not setting out to write a book about, you know, empowering anyone. It just, you know, my it's really a quest, and my main character learns to have he learns that he has agency in the world, and he learns that because of his he learns how to be brave, and and part of that is with the help of friends. He learns that he has friends, and his friends really help him.
Arthur, by the way, is the name that Mira Bartok gives to the fox-like creature. I love some of your other names. For example, villainesses, the woman who runs the home for wayward and misbegotten creatures, you have named her Miss Carbuncle.
Yes, and that's kind of discussed a bit. She has a memory of her father who really kind of neglected her and didn't really love her as much as her sister, her twin sister. And that's the family name is his family name is Carbuncle, and I describe it as a pustule, a boil, all kinds of things. Unfortunate name.
Good stuff. A little bit of Lemony Snicket in here, a little bit of Charles Dickens. By the way, the sketches, the artwork throughout is very reminiscent of a Victorian novel. I know that you're an artist. Is this your work, or did someone else illustrate?
Yes, it's definitely my work.
Oh, wonderful. It is. It really does. It looks like an old Victorian novel. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to have the feel of a kind of classic Victorian novel that you could sink right into on a rainy day or a snowy day. But it also has a modern, edgy feel to it. There are definitely steampunk elements, so there's some futuristic elements in there, like flying bicycles and strange inventions, some for some good, some bad.
I love the combination, Dickens with some steampunk thrown in there. That's great. By the way, it's already being developed as a film. Am I correct on that, Mira?
Yep. It's in development, and it's right now we're getting toward the end of the screenwriter, doing hopefully his final draft of the screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that happens, schedules will be discussed and actors will be discussed. We have discussed some actors, but, you know, it all depends on who's available. I've been very involved from the beginning, which is really great. I'm really lucky. That doesn't always happen. And the director's fantastic. It's Stephen Daldry who is doing the Netflix series called The Crown, and he did Billy Elliot, he did The Reader, so many things. And also he's famous on the London stage for directing, you know, Helen Mirren and The Audience and all kinds of plays.
Yeah,
so
he's top
and it's
shelf.
Also, I mean, the movie, I sold the movie rights for several films as well as a Broadway musical. So we'll see if it happens. I mean, the first movie has to do well. If it bombs, you know, no one's going to go to anything else or make anything else. But if it's successful, there are all kinds of possibilities. So we'll see. Very excited about it.
Well, this is your first book that's aimed at young adults, although quite frankly, I think any adult could read this very, very nicely. However, you are our previous bestseller. You wrote a memoir called The Memory Palace. Tell us a little bit about that, because that ties in a lot with what you've been able to accomplish in your life.
Yeah, it's that the Memory Palace is sort of framed around my striving to remember because I have a lot of memory problems. And from a traumatic brain injury I had in 1999, which I still have, I still have many issues, mostly concentration and endure, mental fatigue, mm-hmm. and memory. I still have a lot of memory problems, but it also has to do with my. It's really about at the heart of the book. It's about my coming to terms with with my relationship with my mother, which my mother was schizophrenic, and the last 17 years of her life she was homeless, and so I found her toward the end of her life, and we were fortunate enough to be together, when she was dying, and so it's a very different sort of book, although there is artwork in there that is my artwork, it's a very different book. It's a very serious book, very emotional book. I know that a lot of people who have dealt with family members who are mentally ill, it really touched them, and I'm still in touch with some of those people. The Wonderling is a very different book. It's but it also deals with people, creatures, characters who live on the margins, who were not really respected they're taken for granted and oppressed. So there's definitely, that's definitely a theme running through both books, oddly enough. And it's a little autobiographical, The Wonderling is, even though the other one was an autobiography. Just because, I was bullied a little bit when I was a kid, and my main character is bullied, and we dealt with it in different ways. I dealt with it in a different way than he did, but in the novel. But it's The Memory Palace, very different book. This is kind of a strange cousin to it in a weird sort of way. And it's also The Wonderling has a lot of humor in it, and The Memory Palace is pretty serious. It's got some dark humor, but. It's pretty serious.
The Wonderling is just recently published. Just to touch more about our guest, she's a real Renaissance woman, listeners. Obviously an artist, she's a musician, a writer. The Memory Palace won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Autobiography. And she's also a translator. She's translated, edited and translated several picture books in, get this, Italian, Norwegian, and also the language of Laplanders, which I am unable to pronounce, Mira.
Sami.
Sami.
Yes.
Wow. Well, listen, I know you're busy here, and I appreciate you chatting with us for a few minutes. Still time, folks, to order The Wonderling if you'd like to stuff it in someone's stocking. The Wonderling by Mira Bartok, with whom we've been chatting for the last few minutes. Nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Much appreciated.
Sure.
And happy holidays.
And to you. And to you, too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Great. Thanks. Bye.
Hey, folks, have you heard about Gone Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center? Still time to get those last-minute gifts shipped to family and friends who are in other parts of the country, and they can do it so quickly and so conveniently, whether you've got one package or 10. That's what they do there. They package your items for shipping by FedEx, by UPS, by U.S. Postal Service, whatever you want. Great for the holiday season, that's for sure, or any time. Gone Postal Butler. They're located at 140 Shockey Lane. It's just off Newcastle Road in the Shockey Mini Storage Complex. I tell you, the two restaurants, King's and Villa Grande, right behind the two of them, just off Newcastle Road. Here's a phone number you can call and see if you need more information about their services, 724-841-0044. 724-841-0044. If you're worried about packaging things up and getting them sent out correctly, your worries are over. Gone Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center, just off Newcastle Road.
You're a dog owner, a dog parent. What does your dog mean to you? Company? Fun? Affection? Sure. But let's add comfort. Your dog offers a level of comfort at just the right time when you need some of that. Comfort. And that's what O'Shea offers at Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler. Comfort. So many people have told us that with O'Shea present at a funeral, she offers a level of comfort that's indescribable. Comfort for the family and comfort for everyone attending. So O'Shea is available for a funeral service, but only if requested by the family. O'Shea creates a feeling of calm, comfort. So come in and meet O'Shea and see why so many folks want her here at a funeral. And while you're here, ask about our unique services, our competitive costs, and our cremation program. Call us at 724-287-3706, 287-3706, or visit our website at www.thompson-miller.com. Thompson Miller Funeral Home, the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Thank our guests for visiting with us. Obviously, Mira Bartok, just a moment or so ago, Drs. Steve Sargent and Tom Schetter, and their fascinating story of climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. And earlier, Clem Rosenberger and Maria Amoruso from Next Year Bank.